Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And welcome, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. If you're listening and it's August 1st, 2010, you're hearing us live. Dawn came early to New Mexico on Saturday morning when a brilliant meteor exploded near Santa Fe. It turned night into day, says amateur astronomer Thomas Ashcroft. This morning around 8:55 UT, Earth orbiting satellites detected a C3 class solar flare. The origin of the blast was sunspot 1092. At about the same time, however, an enormous magnetic filament stretching across the sun's northern hemisphere erupted as well. The timing of these events suggests they are connected, and a review of the Solar Dynamics Observatory movies strengthens that conclusion. Despite the 400,000-kilometer distance between them, the sunspot and filament seem to have erupted together. They are probably connected by long-range magnetic fields. The solar wind is up to 463 kilometers per second. What was once thought to be a stable and predictable star is quickly evolving into a rapidly fluctuating sun with unpredictable effects on the Earth. There were 25 earthquakes in the last 24 hours, with only one over 5.0. The planet is relatively quiet. No space shuttle visits are planned before November. Only two U.S. shuttle missions remain before the fleet is retired. A third and final flight for next summer is under consideration. However, half of the International Space Station's cooling system suddenly shut down during the weekend, forcing the astronauts to power down equipment and face the likelihood of urgent spacewalking repairs. Officials stressed that the six occupants were in no danger and that the orbiting complex was in a stable situation. Much of the station is operating on a single string, however, with no safeguard in case of further cooling system failures. BP inched closer to permanently sealing the blown-out well in the Gulf of Mexico as environmental officials defended themselves Sunday against assertions they allowed the oil giant liberal use of chemical dispersants, whose threat to sea life remains unknown. The Coast Guard routinely approved BP requests to use thousands of gallons of chemicals per day to break up the oil, despite a federal directive to use the dispersant rarely, congressional investigators said. The EPA and the Coast Guard ordered BP on May 24th, more than a month after the spill began, to cut the use of chemical dispersants by 75%. The chemical dispersant was effective at breaking up the oil into small droplets to be consumed more easily by bacteria, but the long-term effects to aquatic life are unknown. That environmental uncertainty has led to several spats between BP and the government over the use of dispersants on the surface and deep underwater when oil was spewing out of the well. BP's apparently generous use of dispersants helps explain why so little oil has been spotted on the surface recently, said Larry McKinney, executive director of the Hart Research Institute for Gulf of Mexico Studies at Texas A&M University, Corpus Christi. Meanwhile, health officials in western Florida are reporting rashes, flu-like symptoms, and fear long-term neurological effects from the chemicals sprayed from low-flying aircraft upwind from their shores. The bleak conclusion of analysts Friday was that unemployment will remain in the double digits for the foreseeable future after the government said economic growth crawled at a 2.4% pace in the spring. It was the economy's weakest showing in nearly a year, and many economists think growth is even slower now. If you still have any cash and checking accounts beyond what you need to make your normal monthly overhead, please take action immediately to get that money somewhere where it will make some interest for you. Just so you're not deceived by the propagandists, the only growth the economy has realized was juiced by government home buying tax credits. Reports of growth are to make you feel better about the economy and to mysteriously start spending your money to bring the economy out of its slump. I guess they haven't figured out that everyone has spent their money on the high price of gasoline and credit card interest, both of which are government-protected profiteers that are soaking the life out of the middle class. Only when the government actually provides assistance to small business manufacturers will unemployment drop and the economy begin to recover. Good news from our publisher, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is through editing and heading for production. The news came in last Friday. We hope to see the first copy in about a week and then off to the presses. So if you want to go ahead and get that ebook copy to get 25% off, you can do that by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Also, Twitter is alive and well on X Squared Radio. I add stuff all day as we approach the announcement of the Inner Earth Expedition and other bits of news about electric vehicles, so keep in touch with us. Also, don't forget to click on the Web Talk Radio link. This is going to give you some excellent short shows, we call them, 30-minute shows. The more you click, the more friends you send there, the better our chances are of syndication. That means we get to play on the airwaves as well as right here on BBS Radio, where we've been for 5 years. We would never change. We'll be back in 40 seconds with our guests. Don't go away. You're going to enjoy this one. Be right back. Science was wrong. A great book, Startling Truths About Cures, Theories, and Inventions They Declared Impossible. Written by authors Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Martin. Both of them are here with us tonight. Stanton was employed for 14 years as a nuclear physicist by major industrial companies working in highly advanced classified nuclear programs. He is the author of Flying Saucers and Science and co-author of Captured. Stan has appeared on hundreds of radio and TV programs, including four times on Larry King Live. Kathleen Martin was trained as a social scientist and educator for 10 years. She served as the International Director of Field Investigator Training for the Mutual UFO Network. A co-author of Captured, Kathleen has appeared in many television documentaries and radio programs and lectured throughout the United States. I got to tell you, in this book, Science Was Wrong, our guests take a 5,000-foot look at the major breakthroughs science has made in the last 100 years or so. Millennia ago, the church and science were one. When Galileo went rogue and tried to claim Earth orbited the sun, the church put him under house arrest, and science fell back into line. In latter days, we have separated the church and the state, but science may have formed its own religion, the Church of the PhD. Our guests tonight are with us. Are you ready to go, Stan and Kathleen?
Yep. Yes, I am.
All right. You know, I love this book. I got Post-it notes sticking out all over the sides of this book, because I think it should be required reading, really, in science history classes, because it really points out the fable, the folly that science continuously falls into, it seems, year after year. It used to be like every 100 years or so we made a real breakthrough and found out, boy, we were really stupid back then. Now we really know the truth. But now we're doing it about every 2 years. Just fascinating stuff in this book. I particularly like the section on flying. You know, we lose sight of where it was and, you know, how we were entertained by all this on the History Channel. But what's the real story of how powered flight came to be?
Well, it was in spite of the nonsense from the noisy negativists, as I like to call them when I'm being polite. Everybody knew that it was impossible. As a matter of fact, the original title for the book was "It's Impossible, Isn't It?" But the publisher has the right to change it, and he did. So science was wrong. It is amazing how much people who knew nothing at all about flying would come out very strongly against it. It's impossible, it's unlikely, it'll never happen. Certainly nobody alive today, said a guy in the year 1900, would make no sense for anybody alive today to study about aviation. And the problem is that the guys who were doing the work, the Wright brothers, for example, everybody says, oh, just a couple of bicycle mechanics. They set up a wind tunnel. They found that the expressions, they read the literature, unlike the debunkers, and they found that when they made measurements, that the literature was often wrong about how much drag, you know, what happens if you change the curvature of the wing, for example, and how much will the fuel consumption be, you know, all kinds of questions. So they ran tests. And they did it objectively and carefully and reran and got on with the job of seeing what they could manage to do. On the other hand, you have people like Simon Newcomb, the greatest American astronomer of the last century, of the 19th century, sorry. He was saying it was clear to him that no fact was clearer, that men would never fly in a machine over long distances. In a machine that was powered. He allowed for balloons, you know.
We had some glider work going on, you know, where was it? Morristown, Tennessee. We had Melvin Murrell that had developed an aircraft that looked like the wings looked like shutters, you know, like you have on your windows. And the shutters would open when the wings went up and closed when the wings went down. And he flew the darn thing all over the hills of, Morristown area. The airport there is named after him. And he filed his patent, I think it was in 1898. And he was offered $100,000 for it, which is a lot of money in those days.
Boy.
And he turned it down and burned it because he said it was the work of the devil.
Wow. That's a great story. We'll have to use that in the next book, I think. You know, Samuel Langley built the glider, and he tried to fly on the Potomac just a few months before the Wright brothers, and Langley's Folly, it was called, because it went down the ramp and crashed into the water. Nobody was killed, and the point here, incidentally, is not that people can be wrong, but when big shots, guys with big degrees and important standing in the community. Newcomb was so important that when he died in 1909, I think, the President of the United States attended his funeral.
Wow.
I mean, this was a big man. So when he says it can't be done, nobody's going to fund somebody trying to do it. And the Wright brothers, as a matter of fact, got turned down twice for funding. They got the last laugh. The contract they had with the government for development of an aircraft said they would get a bonus if they could fly faster than 40 miles an hour. You heard me, 40 miles an hour. And they managed to get to 47, and they got an extra $5,000, which was a lot of money. I mean, not as much as that $100,000 that guy turned down. But the kicker was that how do you get support? The Wright brothers weren't rich. They were self-funded. But they did finally get some support. And the time was part of the thing, that Europe was heading toward war. And Europe, the cities are a lot closer together, and there was a much higher population density. So they could see more point to airplanes. Didn't have to go very far, in other words.
Didn't they load up their airplane after they figured out how to make a coordinated turn, and they went to Paris and flew it as a demo? Was it, 1907 or 1908?
The first flight was in 03, so yeah. They put on some demonstrations, but at the beginning of World War One, incidentally, most of the planes that were being flown weren't Wright Brothers airplanes. Glenn Curtiss built the airplanes. Yeah, and the Russians and the other countries over there had far more airplanes together. Most American pilots were flying foreign airplanes.
Isn't it amazing how you can't go to the government and get a grant to build an aircraft because it's a neat idea, but you can sure get an unlimited budget if there's a war coming on.
That seems to have pushed the development of lots of things. Space, too, after all, the reason for the big rockets. The first satellites were all launched by what were really intercontinental ballistic missiles, easily converted to putting something up in space. The Russians and the Americans, or the Germans working for both of them, which was, you know, the Wernher von Braun and his gang, some went to Russia, some went the United States, but our Germans are better than your Germans, somebody said at one point. But
I'm interested in the sociology of this too. It rarely gets studied, and I want to get Kathleen's input on this, because you know the drive that Wilbur and Orville felt, and the challenges that they have, most of which was to make their engine, because they spent a long, long time learning how to cast iron in order to make their engine. But it was that drive, that incredible feeling of waking up in the middle of the night wondering what it's like to fly above the ground, that drove them to build this aircraft and actually have the nerve to get in it themselves and fly it.
It was gutsy.
There's a lot of excitement involved in that kind of thing, where you almost become obsessed with developing the product that you're attempting to develop and in being the first to do that. There's a lot of excitement about it.
Well, there is. I mean, you look at Edison and Westinghouse and Tesla, how they used to put their sprinting shoes on to run down to the patent office to get that idea patented first. It was unbelievable fever.
Well, when Tesla and Edison both had over 1,000 patents, which is quite remarkable when you think about it. Of course, they lived quite a long while, but still. Now, the drive to be first, to get something new, and the persistence. I mean, Edison tried how many different things before he found a suitable filament for a light bulb? And his view was, well, I know that one doesn't work. He blew a generator one time. Well, I know I can run it well over rated value. I just better stop soon enough. You know? But these guys were, yes, driven is a good word. And they were clever, and these guys weren't loners. The Wright brothers were much more loners than Edison or Tesla. I mean, the Wright brothers pretty much were loners, the two of them together, but Tesla and Edison had staffs of people working with them, and it's a good thing when you think about it that they did. Patents, new ideas. You know, my mantra, and it's in several of my chapters, I guess, in the book, I can't resist repeating it, is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. You have to change how you do things. A laser isn't just a better light bulb. The physics are altogether different. And, you know, here at least you could see a clean-cut product with these guys. Kathy wrote the medical chapters, and I mean, we each wrote 7 chapters out of the 14. But what she saw was people who were being prevented from reducing the misery of the world, which sounds very strange, doesn't it? You'd think everybody would be all for them. Oh, that's got to cure a disease or make people safer, protect children.
Well, as you have this pyramid of, and I love this word that you guys coined in the book, impossibilists. You have these impossibilists that have risen to, I'm going to call it their level of ignorance, their obsolescence. And yet they try to maintain. Yeah, well, they're competent at what they do, but they have stopped at that point. And really, I hate to throw this in here, but we're facing that in the automobile industry right now. We have a government that irrefutably supports the big car makers who have no intention of producing an affordable electric vehicle. And you've got a dozen small companies out there that could do it in 6 months and put a really good vehicle out there, but the government won't give them any money because they want to support, well, we call it the status quo, but they want to support the impossibilists who say a plug-in electric vehicle that's practical for use every day just isn't possible. But we'll be happy to spend your grant money doing it.
Yes. Well, you know, as I say, in these areas you can see technology and profit and all that sort of thing. But it's more disturbing. Kathy want to tell us about one of my favorite people, Ignaz Semmelweis, who was a very important man and perfectly illustrates the resistance of the powers that be to new ideas, new approaches, no matter how beneficial they are. Wouldn't you say that was true, Kathy?
Yes, I would. Ignaz Semmelweis lived in the mid-19th century and taught medical students at the Vienna General Hospital. He had grown up in Pest, in a family, a merchant family, and after high school, he had gone to medical school in Vienna, and when he graduated, he applied to work in the obstetrical unit, and after a time of waiting and learning some more, he was finally accepted to a position where he was supervising medical students, and every morning, he would take them into the morgue, where they would perform autopsies and dissections on the women and infants who had died the day before, mostly from childbed fever. And childbed fever was very perplexing in that time frame. Most doctors thought that it was something that was contagious, maybe it was caused by what they called miasmas, which were putrid odors that were emitted by swamps and maybe outhouses and that sort of thing. Or there was even a theory, it was called the milk metastasis theory, where they thought that the milk from a nursing mother had reverse direction and had moved down into her uterus and had caused her death. And some even attributed it to emotional distress due to their fear of giving birth to these infants. One of the unfortunate things was that the women who were in the Vienna General Hospital, which, by the way, was the largest in Europe, were women who were low income. They might have been homeless. Perhaps they were new immigrants. But most women had the means to afford a doctor to go to their homes and or a midwife, and the mortality rate was low there. Also, the mortality rate was low in the midwife's unit at the Vienna General Hospital. It was generally about 2%. But in the obstetrical unit where the doctors were practicing and learning, the rate was averaging about 20%. And during epidemic periods, what is what they called them, it would increase. And sometimes entire rows of mothers would die within hours or days of each other, and also the infants would. Well, it was quite by accident that Ignaz Semmelweis discovered the probable cause of this. One of his colleagues was in the mortuary, in the morgue, and he pricked his finger on a scalpel, and he ended up developing all of the symptoms of childbed fever and died within days. And
wow.
Childbed fever is actually an infection of the uterus and the genital tract, and it becomes systemic, a systemic infection within hours. So Semmelweis introduced a very simple hand-washing solution and ordered all of his students to, instead of just wiping their bloody hands on their aprons before they performed multiple internal examinations on these women, they would simply wash their hands. And the mortality rate immediately dropped significantly. It actually went down finally to the 2% in the midwife unit where they used wooden models rather than performing dissections. And Semmelweis conducted good scientific work on this. He recorded the results. He very carefully documented all of his statistics. He even did laboratory experiments to support his theory.
And, of course, his work was widely accepted, and he was awarded.
He was asked, he was forced from his position. Did you want to say something? I'm sorry.
I was going to say, of course, he was widely recognized as a hero and given all the awards of a Nobel Prize winner, no doubt.
And lots of doubt.
Well, after his death, he was given much recognition. But during his entire lifetime, he was called a charlatan. He published his findings. He lectured. He attempted to support his findings, but the zeitgeist of the old guard would hear none of it. I mean, you can just imagine them standing there with their hands over their ears yelling, no, no, no. And they refused to even, in many cases, attempt his hand-washing technique. And as a result, thousands of women and infants died needlessly. But after his death, many, many years after his death, he was recognized, and a medical school was named after him. Unfortunately,
they even issued a postage stamp. What a higher honor can you get?
Yeah, exactly. Well, this kind of stuff is flabbergasting to us now. But when you're in that situation, it just, you have to listen to the status quo. We're doing it right now in our engineering and our scientific communities right now. We have the same thing. It's not necessarily the powers that be, so to speak. It's more, maybe the pride of the managers that are in charge of the situation right now. It's like they will not listen to the simplest, most logical, straightforward solution. For instance, one of the write-ups in the book that I really enjoyed was about the Fleischmann Pons cold fusion experiment. You know, I was an undergraduate at the time that this came out, and half the science department said, wow, it's a breakthrough. We're going to move away from fission. We're going to have fusion reactors and make clean energy. And the other half said, that's impossible. There's no such thing as cold fusion. Those guys are charlatans. And I thought they were joking, but that's exactly the argument that came out. Tell us that story, Stan.
Well, there was a big noise when the story came out, and there were unfortunate aspects of it that you sort of can't blame some of the people who reacted negatively. The announcement was made at a press conference in Utah, and normally scientific breakthroughs are made by publishing a paper and in a respected journal, and it's been peer-reviewed, and, you know, people have had a chance to look at it and see, oh, that sounds okay. But by press release? Wow. So they were, on the one hand, people were saying it's a real breakthrough. I should stress here, what's a breakthrough here is that nuclear fusion is the most important source of energy in all our lives. The sun is a fusion factory. And it also has a bad side. H-bombs are fusion devices. But in either case, you're talking about very high temperatures being produced. And so cold fusion without high temperatures, that doesn't make any sense. And the way this thing supposedly worked, you'd have palladium, a metal known to absorb loads of hydrogen. It's used as a catalyst in other places. Pretty expensive, too, more so than gold, generally speaking. Anyway, they had a cell connected with the source of power, battery, basically, and it had palladium, and in it was heavy water. That is, normal water is two hydrogens, H2O for oxygen. This was D2O. D stands for deuterium, which is heavy hydrogen. Normal hydrogen only has a proton on the inside, an electron on the outside. Heavy hydrogen has a proton and a neutron. So it's heavy, but it has the same chemical properties, chemical, not nuclear, because of having the electron on the outside. And so here you load this cell with this heavy water, and you turn on the current, and you get excessive heat. And the idea was there must be fusion going on with that heavy hydrogen being absorbed in the palladium walls. And so it went through a succession of people saying it's impossible, people saying, oh, we did it too, others saying, no, no, no. They got hounded out of the university, finally, and the nasty, noisy negativists were certainly at them. And, you know, don't bother me with the facts. I mean, no matter that new data was published that showed something was going on, it was a disaster for Pons and Fleischmann, basically. But, as I point out in the chapter, as time went on, there were some people with guts, courage to check things out. Maybe we need to increase the ratio of the heavy water to the palladium surface area kind of thing. Maybe change the temperature. Maybe change the current. Let's see what's going on here. And the number of successful experiments producing excess energy kept going up. And, you know, we've got some big guys in the works on this thing, the Electric Power Research Institute, Toyota Corporation, the Navy. Obviously, all of these would, you know, kind of like to have good new sources of power. And so
we all dreamed about having a Mr. Fusion on the back of our cars. Yeah.
Well, Ford has one, doesn't it? A Ford Fusion. Sorry.
I find fascinating, you know, because, you know, it's so much cleaner than fission because, you know, tritium has, what, a 12.5-year half-life. So even if you have...
Well, tritium's the least of your problems with fission. There are many radioisotopes produced when uranium fission.
Oh, yeah.
And so you get, there's quite a backlog of radioactive material produced. Now, it's safe. It's inside the elements and all that. But when I was working on fission nuclear rockets, for example, you can only run them for so long because you need aftercooling. There's so much radioactivity produced in the rocket that you better have some of your hydrogen propellant ready to use once you shut it down because it's still grinding out energy from the radioactive material. So it sounds ideal. And look, there's a long step when you've got new physics, so to speak, and new technology. An idea isn't enough. Reducing it to practice is the difficult part.
Sure.
You know, and so it takes money. It takes effort. And many people are unaware of how much money is spent developing new, different kind of systems. I mentioned in the book that when I was working on nuclear airplanes for General Electric way back in, 1958, GE was spending $100 million that year, employed 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. In other words, it wasn't six professors and 20 grad students.
Yeah, that's a heck of a brain trust there.
Yeah, well, $100 million in 1958 was a lot of money. Now, some people think it's pocket change now. I don't. But then, you know, 3,500 people is a good-sized program.
Back then, you could just about buy a country for that amount of money.
You probably can still do that now if you know whose hands to put the money in. So what I'm saying is that people think you have a eureka moment, you have an idea, and, you know, very shortly thereafter, you're putting it into practice and selling it down at the store, and everybody's buying one, you're making a ton of money. Well, there's a long, slow path between the original discovery. Lasers were invented 50 years ago, for example. And it took quite a while before they started doing useful things like checkout counters and CDs, you know, and stuff like that. But that's
not really the argument of the impossibilist, though. The impossibilist just says heavier than air flight can't be done. You know, it's not how much engineering does it take to get there. I mean, you and I, we look forward to that. You know, give us a box of parts and a half-written manual, and, you know, we're excited. We're ready to go to work. Let's build the darn thing. But impossibilists will say that it just can't happen. It's not going to happen. You're not going to get any money to do it.
And that's why I used the story of Goddard. He wrote a paper, was published in the Smithsonian Journal, and this is around 1920. And the New York Times got a hold of it. In the paper, he suggested the possibility of flight into space. It wasn't just rockets, in other words, in the atmosphere, like for 4th of July. It was flying into space. And the New York Times roasted him. He was a professor at Clark University in New England. He doesn't even know what your normal schoolboy knows, that you need something to react against, and in a vacuum it won't work. Now, that was totally wrong. But the New York Times, in its infinite wisdom, didn't correct it until 1969 as the Apollo Command module was due to land on the moon. Then they said, we regret the error we made. Indeed, according to Newton and other people, it will work. As a matter of fact, it works better in a vacuum because you're not reacting against the gas around the rocket. The stuff leaving the exhaust is reacting against the rocket.
Yeah,
so without the air around it, you've got less drag, and it works better. But this is the New York Times castigating a professor, and nastily, you know, what every schoolboy knows, he doesn't know. And that's the kind of thing. Goddard got very shy about publishing anything and also about doing any experiments. He wound up in everybody's favorite place, Roswell, New Mexico, to do his experiments in the late 30s. He developed the first liquid rocket and stuff, and he died in like 41. And the government belatedly said, oh, yeah, you know, he did some useful work. They gave $1 million to his wife in about 1960 for using his patents, without permission, so to speak. And they did name the big laboratory the Goddard Space Sciences Laboratory, you know. But what I'm saying is the attitude can have such a nasty effect on the ability to get funding and support and people's willingness to stand up and get involved. That's what bothers me. There's always opposition, but when you make it worse by public castigation, that's terrible. You expect better than that from the venerable New York Times.
Yeah, well, we still have that problem today, except now we call it blogging. however, I have to say that the quality of the blogs is a lot better because the person that actually runs the blog, who writes the blog, if it's a bunch of nonsense, there's no advertising, so to speak, to keep it afloat. It's only subscriptions. So if no one's willing to subscribe, the blog goes away. So the blog pretty much has to resonate with people who will subscribe to it and spend $1 or $5 or sometimes $60 to sign up for these things. And they get the occasional advertiser, especially if their web visits get high enough where they can get recognized in such a way. But most of the time, it's just fly by the seat of your pants and try to be as organized as you can and vet your material and get it out there and be smart about it. Now, the good news is that the powers that be are losing their exclusivity on the news of the day. You know, in those days, the New York Times was like the Bible. Everybody got it. Lots of people advertised in it. It was a huge enterprise. Today, information moves in split seconds from the time that it hits the internet to the time it reaches the far corners of the world. So ideas can proliferate a lot better. However, that doesn't necessarily loosen up the money, which is what makes a lot of this stuff happen.
Right, right.
That's right.
And we intentionally included in the book some far out stuff because today's far out today's accepted was yesterday's far out, you know, when you boil it down. And
it's coming quicker and quicker.
Yeah, but some of these areas are important. UFOs are one. Kathy has a great chapter on the abduction phenomena with a lot of references to published scientific data. And there are some people who think, oh, UFOs and abductions, that's all baloney. There is no evidence. The SETI people, so the effort to investigate, I have to get that in. That's what SETI really stands for. say there is no evidence for UFOs. And, of course, they never reference the large-scale scientific studies. And, you know, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. So the book gave us an opportunity to put a lot of references in, a lot of data in, and if people are going to come at us without having read this stuff, which is usually the case, you know. I mean, when I'm on Larry King, I can count on there being some noisy negativist like Bill Nye, the science guy whose purpose is to deny, who knows nothing about the subject at hand. And so by having references and chapters dealing with the data, and, you know, some of it, Kathy tells about the smallpox, which was the scourge of mankind. Kathy had some numbers.
I was going to bring that up. I mean, you talk about car accidents or cancer or whatever. They pale in comparison for how many people almost genocidally wiped out by smallpox.
Yeah.
Kathleen, tell us how early smallpox really made its debut on humanity.
It was in about 10,000 B.C., that it appeared in Northeast Africa and then traveled to Syria and Turkey and Iraq. And by 3000 BC, it was in China and India. And so it just slowly made its way around the world. And when the conquistadors went to the Aztec and Incan empires, the indigenous people had no resistance to the disease, and the conquistadors brought the smallpox virus with them, and they also brought African slaves with them where smallpox was fairly rampant. And it spread through those societies and just laid to waste the inhabitants. Most of them died. And the history of the New World was pretty much shaped by the smallpox virus. It wasn't that the conquistadors had huge armies to conquer and enslave the Aztecs and the Incas, what they had was a disease for which these people didn't have resistance. So their armies were not able to fight. Their leaders were dying. Their entire social structure fell to its knees, and they were conquered for that reason. In the 18th century, 400,000 people in Europe died annually from smallpox, and a third of the survivors went blind, or they were left with deep pockmarked scars that for the remainder of their lives. Now, China was one of the first countries that developed vaccines or inoculations for smallpox. They used a process called variolation. And when you variolate something, you used human pustules. So when someone would have smallpox, they would take the particles or the scabs. And in China, they would use a straw, and they would blow it up the nose of a person, and that person would come down with a mild case of smallpox. Now, some people with lower resistance actually died from the disease, but most people would have just a mild case of the disease and then would be fairly resistant to it for a number of years, and then would have to have the inoculation again.
Well, was smallpox ever used, you know, for military purposes on purpose? I mean, did the conquistadors know that the smallpox would wipe out the Indians?
No.
Well, they gave them blankets.
It was quite by accident when the conquistadors went. But when, as I wrote in the book, what is now the United States was being conquered, smallpox infected blankets were given to the Native Americans as a form of biological warfare, and it succeeded. Unfortunately,
weapon of mass destruction.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Unbelievable. So, did anybody actually discover an inoculation for smallpox that worked besides this blowing
besides
of
variolation? Yes, there was a farmer in England whose last name was Jesty, and he experimented initially by he noticed that the milkmaids who worked on the farms would develop cowpox on their hands when the cows had cowpox, and he waited for a time when there was an infection of cowpox among the cows, and then he took the pustules and he placed it in a little incision under the skin of his wife and children. And this worked. It protected them from smallpox. And it started to be practiced sort of as folk medicine. But it wasn't until Edward Jenner came to the scene. He was a medical doctor and a member of the British Royal Academy. And he started to do experiments where he used cowpox. He had to wait again for an infection. They were fairly rare. And he took the pustules from the cows and inserted them into a number of different people, his patients, his servant's son was one. And so he did scientific experiments to see if this would work, and it did. And he
Who got to take advantage of the immunization? I mean, was it the general population?
No, not at that time. I just wanted to add one thing, if I may, and that is his paper would not be published. The British Royal Society refused to publish his paper because they thought it was too radical. Now, the people who got to take advantage of this were the people who could afford to pay for it. But there was a huge movement against cowpox. what happened was that the political satirists at the time, were drawing cartoons and they were writing songs about the dangers of cowpox. And in one of those cartoons that I have in the book, it showed Jenner administering the smallpox vaccine to people, and they were sprouting horns and tails and udders, and the idea was that you would take on bovine characteristics if you had the smallpox vaccine. So that really frightened people, especially the ignorant people among society. Now, there were doctors, too, who had a vested interest in carrying on variolation because they owned clinics. And in these clinics, they would inoculate wealthy people who could afford to take time off from work and stay in the clinics and the hospitals for a month or two while they went through this entire smallpox process that developed a mild case of the disease. But the disease was contagious, so they had to stay in these hospitals. The general population couldn't afford it, so smallpox was just rampant among that the middle and lower classes.
But among the aristocracy, they were inoculated. They got to keep their pretty white skin, you know, no pockmarks, no death, and so they could outlive the general populace.
That's true. That is very true. And many religious groups were opposed to Jenner's vaccination as well.
They didn't want to mix animals and humans. They didn't think it was right.
Yes. So it was
amazing.
A very difficult journey for Edward Jenner to, he had to self-publish because he couldn't have his work published. Because it was considered to be too radical. And so it was a long, slow process before smallpox was finally eradicated. It was eradicated on May 8th, 1980.
I really don't think it's gotten any better, because I noticed a warning label placed on some products people use to improve their health. It says, "These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease." And yet, supplements and treatments like these that I'm reading off of are a multi-billion dollar industry, some of them with astounding results of improvement of human health. What's going on? Have we not learned from Jenner?
No.
No, those pull the purse strings have a vested interest in perpetuating their system, their way of doing things, and therefore are opposed to natural products and have a lot of government support behind them because they can afford to pay the lobbyists.
And they can advertise. When I was growing up, you would never think to see advertisements for drugs for people. That would be in medical journals. What was it doing Reader's Digest? But
I
now,
ask your doctor about this if you want to be better.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, and wow. The fact that, of course, most drugs don't work for everybody. We have a double standard. The question the debunkers want to ask about UFOs are all UFOs alien spacecraft? That's silly. Of course they're not. The question should be, are any? Does this drug work for everybody? Of course not. But if it works for somebody and you're one of those people it does work for, it's probably worth using. But in other words, we don't expect drugs to be 100% effective with everybody all the time. But there are other areas, you know, psychic phenomena and so forth. If the psychic makes a mistake once in a while, oh, that's terrible. Obviously, this doesn't work. You know, we pay baseball players lots of money for getting a hit a third of the time.
Yes, we do. You know, and if they could beat a third, they get really big money.
Yeah. Yeah, lots and lots. But anything else, oh, no, that doesn't work all the time. That's no good.
I read an article yesterday. It said a new gel being developed by French scientists may mean the end of dental fillings and, even more importantly, the dreaded dental drill. The gel, which stimulates the growth of tooth tissue, may prove a painless cure for dental decay. My question is, how long do you think it will be before we get to see this available and affordable at our family dentist?
The drill companies. The drill companies will be after us.
I have a feeling it's going to say, this product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease, and we'll find it down at the local health food store.
Yeah, unfortunately. And a major point we're really trying to make in the book is that these crazy attitudes by the nasty, noisy negatives have consequences. It's not just a theoretical question, who won the debate, but there is an impact on people. As an example, an English inventor, Frank Whittle, developed a jet engine, got a patent for one in 1930, mind you. The British government wasn't interested. A German inventor, von Ohain, in 1936 got a patent for a jet engine. 6 years later, and yet the Germans built the first jet-powered airplanes.
Sure they did.
And what if the British had developed those jets? Second World War might have been altogether different if they'd had jets up there to defend against the Wehrmacht coming to bomb them. It might have been altogether different. But the resistance to
so.
The ideas, you know. So there are consequences. And
well, you know what? We talk about the consequence of being left on the ground or being left at a military disadvantage or being able to cure one disease or another. I mean, you and I and Kathleen, we travel quite a bit. We see the difference in one county to the next, one country to the next. If they're poor and they don't travel to meet people outside their own community, their noses, their body shapes, their hair texture is fairly common among certain demographics. How does the manipulation or discrimination between one social group, one genetic group or another, seem to fascinate governments?
You mean you got to say bad things about those guys and good things about us?
I remember my mother telling me, I was talking to Kathleen before the program, of the Better Baby contest in Kansas where my older brother was born.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
You know, Gerber was a big baby food company in those days. It was coming on, you know, baby food. We didn't just make food off the farm. You had to buy baby food. And Gerber was sort of on the tail end of this Better Baby contest, you know, and had to be beautiful and had to be, you know, have a great body and great mind and all that. But this was the sort of mixed up in this whole idea of eugenics, wasn't it?
It was. And the Better Baby contest was interesting because it was part of the baby health examination movement. And children through age 4 were judged against a national standard for weight and height, and a grade A was awarded to the fittest children. And the parents of those who received less than an A were encouraged to work to improve the child's grade for the upcoming year. And this went on pretty much before the outbreak of World War II, and it was actually connected to the eugenics movement, which also was sponsoring Fitter Families contests, and had actually been supported in the beginning by the American Agricultural Society Association. So the American Breeders Association, I mean, excuse me. So this was a movement that was really politicized throughout the United States, where the leaders had the intention of getting rid of the lower 10% of the families, the lower 10% of families on the socioeconomic scale. They wanted to eliminate anyone different from themselves from our society through sterilization. And this sort of very slowly slipped in as being something that was projected to the American public as being positive. You know, we want you to be better, we want you to be stronger and fitter, but at the same time, there was that insidious end, that undercurrent of attempting to completely eliminate those who were a drag on society. They wanted to eliminate the blind. And not only those who were blind did they want to stop from reproducing, but also all of their siblings and all of their family members. Somehow the idea was, if we sterilize all of these people, we will never have anyone who is blind again. There was that sort of thing. They did it with epileptics. They did it with anyone who had perceived defects, whether they were mental or physical. And so they were traveling around the country. They had social workers who were working on this as well. And they were making family tree charts. And in these charts, they would have the mother and the father, and they would list all of the defects or perceived defects that these people had. Let's say the father was an alcoholic. That was a defect and reason for possible sterilization. And then they would show how alcoholism was passed down through the family. And all of these people were considered defective, so, you know, of course we needed to sterilize them, and if we had that entire family sterilized, then we would no longer have alcoholism in our society.
We should just do that with politicians.
And they did this to several different groups. They did it, they declared some people feeble-minded, and there was really no definition for being feeble-minded. There was a woman, for example, a young woman, Carrie Buck's mother, and her father had died, and the mother was left alone raising four children. Well, she was supporting herself through prostitution, and she was a drag on the society in Virginia. So her children were taken from her. She was declared feeble-minded. And she was placed in the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and the Feeble-Minded in Lynchburg, Virginia. And her daughter ended up being sterilized after she gave birth to a child out of wedlock. In the end, we found out that that daughter was of normal intellectual capacity and had actually been raped by her foster parents' nephew. But was also placed in the Virginia colony, state colony for the epileptics and feeble-minded, and sterilized. And her young daughter was placed with those foster family who had raised her. So it was a very difficult situation.
It probably sounds like Hitler to some people listening, the master race, the super race. And what particularly bothered me, all my grandparents came from Eastern Europe. And these guys were giving intelligence tests in English to people who came in who couldn't speak English and saying, see, they're feeble-minded, can't pass a simple test.
I was just going to ask, how does immigration affect the idea of eugenics?
Well, you don't want those immigrants. They're obviously unsuitable, inferior, to be kept out, You know, a lot of Nobel Prize winners come out of that group of people.
I reckon so. A lot of great baseball players, too. You know, I remember when C.W. Post and Dr. Kellogg.
Eastern European Jews and Southern Italians. And so they immediately wanted to give IQ tests to these people and, of course, administered in English with questions pertaining to the locations of the five top universities in the United States or the colors of certain gemstones. Really a great test of one's intelligence. And it was used as a way to attempt to prevent immigrants from coming into this country. It was clearly discrimination.
Right, right. But, you know, that happens inside our country, too. You know, and there are efforts to fight that. I remember when C.W. Post and Dr. Kellogg were trying to find a way to make a more fit human being. Now, C.W. Post was kind of a health food proponent. He came up with all kinds of cereals and breads that we still use today.
Yes.
I mean, who can forget Tony the Tiger, you know, with Kellogg's? So do we still have the effects of eugenics in our society today, as cosmopolitan as we are?
Well, there's certainly a lot of public attitudes that indicate certain groups of people are obviously inferior. You know, Hitler, fortunately, in some ways, Hitler carried it to an extreme, and that put a break on the eugenics movement in the United States. I'm not saying Hitler was good. I'm just saying that because of his excesses, you know, talking about the master race and stuff, finally some Americans woke up. But as is pointed out in the book, some of the people who supported this kind of stuff were rich people.
Exactly. Yeah. Wealthy people are definitely not feeble-minded because obviously they've been blessed by God, the old Calvinist doctrine.
Absolutely. And some of that money from some of the wealthiest families in the United States went to fund Joseph Mengele's experiments in Germany. And the University of Heidelberg awarded an honorary doctorate to one of the two leaders of the American eugenics movement. When the Germans were becoming more and more successful at eugenics, perceived by the eugenics movement in the United States, the United States organization was lamenting the fact that the Germans were beating them at their own game.
Well, you know, it's interesting. On the legal side of things, there was a woman who led the fight for a long time and ended up on the U.S. Supreme Court. Her name, Ruth Bader Ginsburg,
mm-hmm.
a big proponent of eugenics.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Just taught me something.
Interesting.
That wasn't in any of the research that I had done.
Me neither.
Well, if you follow the documentation that is held by the Right to Life group, and you follow Ruth Bader Ginsburg back about 40 years, you will see that that is what she was involved in.
Mm.
It's kind of interesting. Little known facts once people get elevated to that level. Let's bring it a little more current. You know, we've had a real flap of late on the idea of global warming. It's one of the recent fables that we have. The real question is, which one is the fable? Are humans impacting the Earth or not?
Well, yeah, there are two separate questions here. Is the world warming or cooling or doing anything else? And whatever it's doing, is man responsible for it? And the biggest, of course, is that small group of very noisy people who think that CO2 is the biggest evil in man's history. If we can only reduce the amount of evil CO2 we produce, then everything will be okay. The world won't, you know, the glaciers won't melt. Everything will be fine. The trouble is, what I've found is that, again, we have noisy negativists, and some of it's been exposed. In the past year, there's been a major effort on the part of some of the news media to dig into things like ClimateGate, all those emails out in England and Anglia, East Anglia University, where basically they were saying, hey, we got to watch what we let get published. We can't have any disagreement. We have a party line here that all scientists agree that evil CO2 needs to be defeated, and we need to spread money, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars, from the rich countries, which are the ones producing all that bad CO2, to the poor countries. It's not their fault, it says here in small print. And so there has been a growing recognition that that's a gross simplification. It's kind of like the talk about conundrums. The people who are anti-nuclear don't want to build nuclear power plants, even though they're pro, do something about global warming. We have to reduce the amount of CO2, and the best way to do that, of course, in a power plant is nuclear, which doesn't produce any CO2. So there's a dichotomy there that I don't know how they live with themselves. We want to reduce CO2, but we don't want any of those nuclear power plants, boy. And fortunately, in several European countries, within just this past year, there has been a strong movement to get rid of the rules that they had temporarily passed to shut down all the nuclear power plants, to offer huge subsidies for the development of the building, fabrication, erection of solar power plants, windmills, and so forth. People were winding up paying huge, much more money for their power than with normal fossil fuel systems. And the countries found that, hey, who can afford this? Wait a minute, what are we doing here? getting a lot of money.
There's no doubt that we have scientific armies lining up on both sides. I mean, you have people that say, are you crazy? Of course the Earth is warming. And yet we have others that say, now, wait a minute, glaciers have been growing steadily for the last 7 or 8 years. We really haven't seen any temperature rise in over 11 years. So what are you griping about? And the worry is that you got the Al Gores of the world who have made a tremendous political football out of this and managed to move literally billions of dollars around to enrich their friends who are involved in, of course, green technologies. So the big, what does the public do? What do they believe? Which is the scientific folly? You have credible scientists on both sides pointing fingers at each other, some saying it's absolute nonsense, others saying, hey, it's been over 90 degrees now for 21 days in a row on the East Coast. Who says the world's not warming?
Whose fault is it that it's warming? And also, people don't seem to realize CO2 is not the largest greenhouse gas. It's water vapor. But that's a lot harder to predict. And you can't blame it on anybody. We make CO2 in our power plants and with our vehicles and so forth. But water vapor is all over the place. And also,
go back and get the historical information from ice and from tree rings. What do the tree rings tell us?
Well, one of the most interesting tests, if you will, experiments that I found was in Scotland, where the dendrochronology, they cut a bunch of trees that had all been planted at the same time, and they froze the pieces, and they monitored the growth as you move across the ring, years, hot, cold, whatever. And what they found, surprisingly, was that what determined the best correlation they had with the growth of the tree rings had to do with the solar cycles and, more importantly, in that case, with the cosmic rays, particles from out there. And in the news broadcast at the beginning of the show, they talked about this big solar storm up on the sun and the importance of the magnetic fields and all that. Well, you go back 50 years, magnetic fields have no place in what goes on in the sun. It's all gravitational, and we have this solar constant, which isn't constant as it turns out. The sun is always putting out the same amount of energy, but there's a lot of recent data with the new satellites, which can observe from above the atmosphere, and are finding the great importance of the magnetic fields and the great importance of the variation in output of the sun and how the particulate matter, the radiation and particles from the sun, influence the atmosphere, and that in turn influences the weather. And so when we find that there's a cyclic phenomena, and it has to do, the temperatures, in other words, follow the path of the variations in the sun. And as a matter of fact, it's been shown that the climate on Mars has been following this same path, and ain't no CO2 being produced by us Earthlings up there on Mars, last I checked, anyway.
There must be SUVs up there.
That's what it is. That's what it is. You got it. So,
you know what? The whole idea, I mean, I think what cankers science is when politicians get involved and realize there's one tax or another that will fatten the federal checkbook or suppress one industry or another according to the votes they can supply. But this is really no change from the early days that we've been talking about, from the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, when the crown would authorize the genocide of one race or another so their lands could be confiscated. I mean, the Bible is full of divinely commanded genocide. So has science changed at all?
Different areas, but no, what hasn't changed is people. It's not the science. It's people's need for being important, for being powerful, for having the opportunity to lord it over others, to use an English phrase, I guess. And we don't seem to have made much progress in changing that. You know, human nature, so to speak. And
yeah.
There's always a bad guy. Remember, we're good and they're bad. I remember during World War II, those comments about the Japanese and the Germans. You know, we demonized them. Look how we put the Japanese in those internment camps.
Yeah, so we demonized them and we dehumanized them. Maybe it is that people are the same age after age. They have their prejudices, they have their fears. But, you know, these generally aren't the people that are doing the peer reviews. They're not the people that are at the heads of these institutes or institutions that analyze the data and supposedly can make some third party a fair decision. One of the things Kathleen and I were talking about before the program was the parapsychology industry. You know, in the early parts of the 20th century, a tremendous amount of money was spent by most of the developed countries on parapsychology. And I've read a few books on it. So much clinical data was collected, but the conclusions were never made. The analysis was never brought forward. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that. It's such a tremendous area. And really, I think now we're seeing a resurgence in it. We're seeing psychic healers and intuitive counselors and a real gift coming forward now. So, Kathleen, tell us a little bit about the coming of age of parapsychology.
Well, parapsychology, as you mentioned, has been conducting independent replications of controlled experiments performed thousands of times by researchers around the world, and they have demonstrated statistical evidence in support of psi phenomena. The problem was that they were accused over and over again of bias in their experiments, that even if they weren't aware that the bias was there, there were human variables in there. Perhaps the cards were bent, or perhaps when the experimenter and the experimental subjects were working together, that the something on the experimenter's facial expression would cue the psychic of the person participating in the experiment to give the response that was expected. And over time, scientists who were working on psi phenomena on these experiments asked the skeptics to come in and help them to design experiments that would eliminate these human variables. And they ended up coming up with a great telepathy experiment. It's called the Ganzfeld telepathy experiment. It was developed in the early 1970s. And in this Ganzfeld experiment, there would be a sender and a receiver. And they would be isolated in soundproof rooms. And the receiver would have ping pong ball halves covering his or her eyes, and there'd be white noise in the room. And then the sender would be isolated in a separate soundproof room. And then over closed circuit video, it would send random images, such as nature scenes or photos of different things. And that would come into the sender's room. And the sender would telepathically attempt to send this image to the receiver. So they did everything they could to eliminate this human variable element where they might not get accurate scientific results. And in doing this over and over again, they did it over 2,500 times, they came up with lots and lots of evidence that telepathy is real. Now, this was challenged.
Were there people that were particularly gifted at it, or could everybody learn it? Was this a natural human characteristic?
What they found is that some people were particularly gifted at it. And if they had a person who was a gifted psychic in one room and maybe a friend of that person in another room, the experiments had much, much better results.
Because the wavelengths were familiar to one another. They knew the thought patterns of what was going back and forth.
Yes.
We had Dr. Edgar Mitchell on this program, and he talked about the experiment that he ran with telepathy while he was going to the moon, because he wanted to prove whether or not thought could actually leave the planet and go to the moon and back. And although Olaf Johnson prematurely exposed it to the press, which kind of took away the thunder and allowed some criticisms to come on the experiment, it was very statistically significant that Edgar Mitchell was receiving images that were being sent to him telepathically from Earth, and he was writing them down all through the mission on his knee pad. And that was, I thought, fascinating.
Yeah.
Edgar is a very gutsy guy. You know, he wrote the foreword to my book, Flying Saucers and Science. And talks about Roswell, because he grew up around there, incidentally. Not everybody has his courage, but we're so lucky that people like him, some of them, are willing to speak out. You know, we want to put the kibosh on anybody who pretends to be or seems to be different. Sometimes, and in Flying Saucers and Science, there's information on public opinion polls, and what one finds often is that even though most people believe a particular phenomena exists, like telepathy, let's say, or UFOs, they will act as if they didn't because people they think would think they were a nut.
Yeah, exactly.
So it gets in the way. In other words, a lot of progress is being delayed because, I didn't report what I saw because they think I was a nut. I actually ran a little experiment in a class. This is not fancy, but I asked them to close their eyes and vote with their hands, and I would ask some questions, and their instructor and I would count the votes. It had to do with whether they believed that most people believe in UFOs, most people didn't, etc. And would you believe, 80% thought most people didn't believe in UFOs, but 80% of that very group did believe that some UFOs are intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. And so the resistance, the fear of ridicule or disdain from respectable people would stand in the way, whether you were talking about telepathy or UFOs or seeing what goes on inside somebody's body. There's a whole chapter that Kathy did about, what's her name, Demkina.
Kathy? Natasha Demkina. Yes, Natasha. It was in the side chapter where she was a medical intuitive, and she took part in a medical experiment in the United States, and it was recorded for the Discovery Channel in 2004. And she thought that she was actually working with some of the top scientists in the world. She traveled from Russia with her mother. She was a young girl. And she had been deceived. It was actually the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, and it was then called SICOP, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. It's a debunking group. And they designed an experiment that would increase her chances of failure. They placed her under stress. They made sure that she was good and tired and suffering from jet lag. They were hostile to her, she claimed. She wasn't able to read people the way that she usually does. And a medical intuitive that I did a radio program with told me this is extremely important. You have your way of doing things. You have to have people alone, and you have to read them individually. This committee lined people up close together and asked her to read conditions that the committee had already determined these people had. They would say one person had it when actually two or three in the group might have had it, but she had to choose the one. So there was a lot of bias on the side of the Committee for Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. And when she did extremely well, when she would have passed this test by international standards, they raised the bar. And she actually signed a paper saying that it was all right with her, that she didn't know. She had no one who was knowledgeable about this to advise her. And the poor young girl ended up crying at the end of the show, claiming that they were biased, that they had mistreated her. And in fact, they actually had. But a number of people came to her side and supported her side of the story. One of them was Brian Josephson, Ph.D., the Nobel Prize-winning physicist and director of the University of Cambridge's Mind-Matter Unification Project. And he criticized the experimental team's methodology and motives. So she did have people on her side who were supporting her. And later follow-up studies, for example, in Japan, said that there was significant evidence that she actually did have the ability that she claimed to have.
Hmm. Well, I have met individuals who have this ability to be able to look into you or look into another person and see an injury. And honestly, I've even met them that could do it over the phone. They don't even have to be next to the person. They can just visualize the person as they're speaking to them on the phone and tell them, you know, where this ailment is, what this problem is with them. And sure enough, they go to the doctor and, you know, there's an old splinter that's festering, just like she said, or whatever the problem is. I'm amazed by it. I don't understand it, but I have to admit that although I am an instrumental physicist, my skill set is in, you know, measurements with all kinds of instruments. I have to admit that the human body is one very sophisticated biological transducer, and it's capable of detecting all kinds of things that we just do not generally accept yet.
Well,
I agree.
Well, I'm just going to mention that Dr. Shafika Karagula has written a book about, she was a medical doctor, but she could diagnose the people when they came into her office, but she would have tests run just to back it up. And when after she wrote the book, she heard from a lot of doctors who said they do it too. They could tell
right. What
was wrong. And, you know, if it works, use it, is my feeling.
That's kind of what draws them to the science, too. And then they have to learn the medicine behind it. But that's what draws them to it. They have an affinity for it. They have this natural ability.
Well, you know, the British learned to feed their sailors on the high seas limes. That's why they call them limey. It was a long time before they realized it was vitamin C. It hadn't been discovered at the time. The same thing happened with treating pernicious anemia, which was invariably fatal, but in the 20s they could create the condition in dogs and feed them all kinds of stuff and see what worked and what didn't, and they found that feeding them liver would cure the problem. Now, it was many years before they found out that it was what it was in the liver. And we're talking about vitamin B12, and we're talking, you know, minuscule amounts, micrograms. So you don't always have
the
to
Romans
understand.
The Romans used to put silver coins in their water drums to keep bacteria from growing in them.
Huh. Well, there's a guy in our book who wrote a book about the body electric, a man named Becker, who did a lot of work with silver, various silver compounds as treatments for disease. And he also found that he could, crazy as it sounds, use electrical devices to cause mending of broken bones, which otherwise didn't mend. Most bones do heal, you know. But in ones that don't, if you put the right current in the right place with at the right strength, you could induce healing.
Absolutely.
I mean, he was looking at why is it that what are these critters that you can cut off a limb and they grow in salamanders?
Salamander.
How the heck does that happen? So, and he found again that electrical stuff, appropriately used, would enhance the process. Now, some of this sounds crazy, but the experimentalist says, "Well, let's see. I can see a possible reason for this happening, and maybe it turns out to be the wrong one, but it's what happens that matters. And that's the thing, that we are still ignorant. I mean, maybe some people don't think we know.
We're not stupid, we're ignorant. We just don't know. You know, we've danced around this subject all night long, and it's kind of the granddaddy of them all. More than half the world knows they exist. There are so many pictures and measurements that they exist that only a fool would doubt their existence. And yet, scientific groups like Caltech and NASA deny they ever existed. And certainly, they do not exist today. And I'm talking about UFOs. In your book, you have this marvelous statement. I've got to quote it. It says, "In summary, there is an enormous amount of information indicating that Earth is being visited by advanced alien spacecraft. Despite vociferous claims to the contrary by the educated individuals who have not reviewed the evidence, Science is wrong again, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, and it's an area, of course, close to my heart. I've only lectured at more than 600 colleges and 100 professional groups in all 50 states, 9 provinces, and 16 other countries. So I've had plenty of opportunity to see what the reaction is. My lecture is usually flying saucers are, underlined, capitalized, real, exclamation point. And incidentally, I better add, it's not just me talking. I've only had 11 hecklers in all those lectures, and two of them were drunk. And, you know, you'd get that many if you were talking about sports, religion, politics, so I'm told anyway. But, yeah, we have a strange situation here. Most people think they're real, but most people think, as I said earlier, that other people don't think they're real, so they better not speak out. And what bothers me is the bad science used by the nasty, noisy negativists, the people who tell you there is no evidence. And you keep looking for the references. Well, I don't see any mention of any of those 5 large-scale scientific studies I talk about. What's the basis for your views? They don't have any. They just know it can't be. And
I have a lot of friends that are astronomers, and when we go out to dark sky events, they say, okay, now listen, no talk of UFOs out here, okay? We're looking at stars. Anything you see flying overhead is a satellite. So shut the heck up. You know, come on, for crying out loud. One of the biggest areas of denial is they say it's impossible to travel at the speed of light, and even if it was, it would take 100,000 years to cross the Milky Way alone. So travel is not feasible.
Yeah, that's one of those things where you listen and you say, look at what you just said. Yes, let's assume that it's true that the galaxy is 100,000 light years across. But what has that got to do with the question of whether we're being visited? There's 2,000 stars, roughly, within 55 light years of the Earth, and 8 times that many within 100 light years of the Earth. Why would anybody in his right mind worry about, gee, I can't get to the other side of the galaxy? Who cares? You know, if I need a loaf of bread, I don't say, gee, that bakery in Australia is great, but I can't get there and back in time for dinner. My wife would say, hey, the superstore is a mile and a half away, and we need it for dinner tonight, not next week. Don't go to Australia. You know, and one of the things that is really astonishing to me is that astronomers, who very well know that nuclear fusion is what produces the energy of the universe, if you will, can't imagine that anybody could use that for propulsion. I worked on fusion propulsion systems, studies of them, back in the early 60s, for goodness sakes. If you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. You know, I don't use a slide rule anymore. Why would you determine how many calculations you can make per year using a slide rule instead of a computer? Well, why would you talk about chemical rockets to get to the stars? And why would you look at distant stars as opposed... I had one guy, an astronomer, say, but, you know, Andromeda is an awful long ways away. Think of how much energy it would take. That's 2 million light years away. Who cares? You know, let's not try to solve that problem.
You know, with the ion drives that you're talking about, we could accelerate at half to 1G for a few months and then decelerate at about that same amount, and we'd be there.
Well, you know, I use the example in the book of Dr. Campbell, an astronomer who in 1941 was sick and tired of all his science fiction stuff about sending a man to the moon. And he set out to write a professional scientific paper loaded with equations in which he would show what the required initial launch weight to do that was. That's a good question. You know, how big's the thing got to be? That's a reasonable question. So he did that. He published the paper, and the bottom line is the rocket would have to weigh 1 million tons. Not pounds, tons. Now, the only trouble is he made every possible wrong assumption. For example, he assumed a limit of 1G acceleration. The astronauts routinely take 5. He assumed a single-stage rocket. Bad advice. He assumed the only way you could slow down when you get back is a retro rocket, which, of course, you have to lift from the Earth, slow down at the moon, lift from the moon, slow down back here. He also assumed, and we don't do that, we use the atmosphere. You know, we don't need to put it there. Kind of nice. I call it cosmic freeloading. Take advantage of Mother Nature. We also launched to the east from near the equator. There's a free 1,000 miles an hour. And when we go to the moon, there's a launch window, a certain period of time where you want to launch in that period of time. Why is that? What difference does it make? Well, it makes a heck of a difference because you want to use the moon's gravitational field. If you launch at the right time, the moon will come along and do its thing. You don't need to do anything about it. Be in the right place at the right time. It's a freebie. Let's look at the bottom line on this. We got 3 guys to the moon and back. The initial launch weight of this dumb old chemical rocket was a big one, was 3,000 tons. Dr. Campbell was off by a factor of 300 million. I mean, that's a good size mistake, I'd say. Not 3 million, 300 million. And so if you make enough wrong assumptions about doing anything, one of them is space travel. Incidentally, I try a little experiment. Sometimes on campus, I get informed by the students that the professor was going to try to make an example of me in a little seminar in the afternoon, show how stupid this guy who says flying saucers are real is. So I make sure that I talk about things that I know they don't know anything about. You're all familiar with that, I'll say, and no hands go up. You know, and after I've done that a few times, they realize that maybe their professors aren't as smart as they think they are. But then I play a little game. I'll say, what's the value of 1G, the numerical value of the acceleration of gravity at the surface of the Earth?
32 feet per second.
They automatically say 9.8 meters per second squared. And I say, yeah, that's right, but how do you relate that to the real world, like Corvettes? And they look at me like I'm talking Swahili. I mean, you know, you mean you're supposed to relate this to the real world? Yeah. To give you numbers, 1G acceleration is 21 miles per hour per second. So if you accelerate at 1G for 3 seconds, you'd be going 63 miles an hour. And that's a pretty hot car. Most cars take 4, 5, 6 seconds to get to 63 miles an hour. Okay, then I say, what's the speed of light? 300,000 kilometers per second. They're going to show how smart they are. I say, yeah, that's true, but how do you relate that to the real world? 670 million miles an hour. And that's meaningful because the Jupiter and Saturn are a few hundred million miles away, so that gives you a scaling factor. I said, but the real question is, how long does it take at 1G to get to the speed of light? And you don't need to do any calculating. It's a multiple choice question. 1,000 years, 100 years, 10 years, 1 year. And I'll ask how many think it's 1,000, how many think it's 100, et cetera. You'd be amazed at how many think it's 1,000 or 100 or 10. The answer is 1 year. One. Single. Uno. But they don't know about it. They're not concerned with the real world. And they also, isn't it amazing how people want to use half an Einstein? You know, you can't go faster than the speed of light. Oh, but we're not going to talk about the fact that you get closer to the speed of light, time slows down for the things moving that fast. At 99.99% of the speed of light, you can go 37 light years in 6 months pilot time. And we Earthlings know a little about things going close to the speed of light. Mother Nature provides. But that big collider over in Europe there, 99.999, I think there's another 9 in there someplace, percent of the speed of light. So it's not out of the question. But they don't want to talk about that. And it's incredible to me that people who consider themselves scientists refuse to do their homework about interstellar travel. And there is an intermediate step between chemical rockets, Saturn V rocket, and nuclear fusion. There's nuclear fission. I worked on fission rockets. We built them. We tested them. Los Alamos built the biggest one, less than 7 feet in diameter. The power level was 4,400 megawatts. That's twice the power of Grand Coulee Dam, 7 feet in diameter. So that's an intermediate step. You could use it for an upper stage. Nuclear energy, I mean, after all, the Nautilus went underwater as a nuclear-powered submarine back in the 50s, for goodness sakes. So it's not unheard of to use nuclear energy. Do you know that we have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers? I mean, they don't belong to me, but the United States government has them. And can go for 18 years without refueling? I mean,
yeah,
that's the real world.
18 years without fueling.
What?
18 years without fueling, but they do have to stop for food because it's hard to carry 18 years worth of food. And,
well, that's right.
we were talking about the speed of light, you know, getting halfway there, getting a third of the way there, you know, 300,000, what should we say, 60,000 miles per second. That is, what, 20 times faster than our fastest rockets?
Well, yeah, and that's the point, that it's not like you need to be a dreamer reaching into the future hundreds of years in your dreams to see how we're going to do this. This is the real world we live in. I mean, and I mentioned fusion before. We've created fusion devices. The first one must have been a shock to the aliens. Can you imagine 1952, out in the middle of the Pacific, all these ships going down there, and they set off Mike at the end of October 1952. Power level, energy release level, it was 10 million tons of TNT equivalent. 10 million tons! That really, and the fireball was only 3 miles wide. I mean, we're not talking a little firecracker here. And, you know, a big bomb during World War II, not too many, less than 10 years earlier, was 10 tons of TNT equivalent, a 10-ton blockbuster. And people act as if none of these things had happened. You know, I just watched a little thing on my computer today. We've had over 2,000 nuclear weapons exploded on this planet.
That's a lot.
Well, I mention it only because some people say, well, why would somebody come here? What's his name? Stephen Hawking was saying, we shouldn't let the aliens know we're here. Of course, they've been here, but we don't talk about that. Because look what happened to the natives when Columbus showed up. Well, the natives didn't have weapons of mass destruction. They didn't have large-scale reconnaissance systems, spies in the sky and radar and all kinds of stuff. We've exploded lots of nuclear weapons. And I've heard one of these SETI characters, well, why would they come here now? It must be because of the people think they've come here because they've been watching too much science fiction. But nonsense. For the first time, the last 50 years anyway, we show signs of being able to go to other stars and take our brand of friendship out there. If you were an alien, wouldn't you be concerned? We only killed 50 million of our own kind.
We also have the ability to travel to other bodies in space. We've done it several times in a little titanium aluminum can. I just heard Buzz Aldrin tell his story of Apollo 11 when he called Mission Control because they looked out the window and noticed that there was something out there, and they had jettisoned their final stage 2 days earlier. But they called Mission Control because they discussed among themselves that, look, we can't just call Mission Control and say, Houston, we have something outside of our window. So they decided among themselves that they would call and say, Houston, Mission Control, what's the location of the SB1. That's their final stage. And Houston answered back about 6,000 nautical miles. It never registered with Houston. Because I guess it was really hectic there, and the communication was kind of gravelly anyway, because nobody came back and said, "Why do you ask?"
They didn't want the answer to that.
Yeah, but as it turns out, and Buzz was talking about this on the documentary on the Science Channel, almost all the Apollo members that went out into space around the moon and back or landed on the moon report craft following them, not for minutes, for hours, going to the moon.
Did Buzz say that on the air?
He said it tonight. I watched it when my jaw was on the floor. I recorded it on my TiVo. I could not believe it.
I've appeared on television with him twice, once with Larry King and once with Ron Reagan Jr., and he certainly never said it then. He dodged around it, but...
Maybe Edgar Mitchell's broken the ice. You know, he's been really vocal the last year, but I couldn't believe it. This was just recorded just a couple of months ago, and I said to myself, that's Buzz Aldrin. I cannot believe he just said they called Houston and said, "Where's the SB1?" Because outside their window, and they were looking at it with a telescope out the window of the craft.
Well, I'm glad to hear that he's gone more public with that. Maybe that's going to start a little, a trend.
A trend, maybe. These people, and I'm sure he signed papers and agreed never to talk about it. He said he spoke about it in debriefing, you know, when they returned to Earth.
Yeah.
But, he was probably advised at that time, you know, never say another word about this as long as you live. But the reasoning that he said that they advised them not to do it was because it would hurt their credibility.
Yeah.
It would hurt
Isn't that
their
crazy?
Credibility. Not that it would panic the people or ruin churches or, you know, destroy governments, but that it would ruin his credibility.
Well, when Dr. James E. McDonald, who was the finest ufologist ever as far as I'm concerned, his congressional testimony was A number one in 1968, 41 cases you couldn't explain, et cetera. But when he's a professor, his field was atmospheric physics. He testified before Congress at hearings about the SST when Boeing was trying to get money to fund it. And he was pointing out that it would change the ozone layer. And when he was up there giving testimony, one of the congressmen from Boeing State, you understand, "Oh, you're the guy who believes in flying saucers." I think it was worse than that, but I'm trying to be appropriate here. Made a fuss about that. As if you must be some kind of a nut. There was a little financial concern there, of course. Boeing wanted that contract. But, you know, along with the business, you can't get here from there, I'd better throw in one other thing. And that is that governments can't keep secrets. The NRO announced about 3 years ago that they had canceled a program with Boeing to change the architecture of satellites, and they had only spent $14 billion. Didn't get what they wanted either, incidentally, and it was kept secret all that time. Lockheed, $10 billion to build the stealth fighter. People who say governments can't keep secrets don't seem to understand how the system works. One thing we haven't done.
Compartmentalize, and it's pretty easy to keep secrets.
Yes, it is. And there's a lot of secrets out there. And one secret we won't let you keep is that my website is www.stantonfriedman.com. And Kathy has a website, which is... Kathy? Did we lose Kathy?
I don't know. I guess we did. What's her website? We got stantonfriedman.com.
Kathleen-Marden.com. That's a hyphen, not a, you know. They can go to my website and get hers also, and it lists all the books. Her website, there's a link. The books are available, and I would stress one thing. You can buy from Amazon, you can buy from Barnes & Noble, you know, Borders, whatever. But you won't get our signatures, you won't get our autographs. All our books that the two of us have written, captured in Science Was Wrong, have little bookplates with both our signatures, and they're genuine. So you can't get those from the bookstores, but we don't
want
to buy them from the bookstores. But, you know, and I mention that only because sometimes people say, well, I didn't see your book in a store. Well, it's not easy to spot a book out of, I'm just at a bookstore today. A lot of books in that bookstore. You know, unless you know where to look. And that's one of the strange things. UFO books generally are in with the New Age stuff. Science Was Wrong is in the science book section, believe it or not. A strange world.
Interesting. So we need to put the word science in our title if we're going to end up in the science section.
I guess it might sell better in the other.
Well, you two are going to be appearing at the Burlington Vortex Conference this October.
Yeah, around Halloween
with
time.
Mary Sutherland up in Wisconsin. Any other conferences coming up soon?
Well, I'll be speaking in Exeter, New Hampshire. These are listed on my website, incidentally. I'll be speaking in Exeter on, remember that famous incident at Exeter book? Well, they're having their second annual conference, and that is September the 4th in Exeter, New Hampshire, which is not far from Portsmouth, between Portsmouth and Boston, but much closer to Portsmouth. We will both also be speaking in Phoenix at a conference in February. Again, it's listed on the website. It used to be the Laughlin Conference for 20 years, and it got sold, and now it's being held in Phoenix, right next to Scottsdale there, at a resort. And boy, it'll be a lot warmer there than it will be in Fredericton, New Brunswick, when I live in February. I'm also speaking in Strasbourg, France, in October. And I've had an invitation, it's not listed on my website yet, to go to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, would you believe, on a session
for
innovation, and they're interested in talking about extraterrestrials. And I was surprised. Wow. I tried to check things out to make sure this wasn't a joke, you know. But I'm looking forward to that. That should be intriguing.
Well, I can't tell you how much.
Oh, Angel Fire, New Mexico. Don't forget Angel Fire, New Mexico, the 9th through the 12th of September. It's up in the mountains. Pretty area, I'm told.
All right. I've got all those. I've got your website linked at X Squared Radio. I so appreciate both of you coming on the program. I met Stan and Kathleen up at the Burlington UFO Conference last October. Had a wonderful time. And if you get a chance to make your way up there, you can really get up close and personal if you want to get to know two of the more famous spokesmen in this genre. really enjoyable time. And I really appreciate you coming on the program. And I
Our
love
pleasure.
The work you're doing out there.
Thanks much for having us.
All right. Have a good evening, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, Earth Explorers, we'll take a quick 4-minute break. Let everybody get a drink, and we'll come back right after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming up. We're glad you're here with us tonight on X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from North Carolina. Had some interesting weather lately. A lot of rain, heat, humidity. Really unusual for this time of year. Usually we get some warm weather in the 80s, but not consistently up near 100 degrees. Also, during the winter time, we had extended periods of cold weather and lots of snow, as I'm sure most of the eastern part of North America experienced. One of the more interesting things that we bring up on this program from time to time is the existence or non-existence of UFOs. Now, you listen to this program, it's because you are a believer, you are an enthusiast, and you may even have seen one on your own. So we'll start a little higher up the ladder. Final part of last hour, we were talking about the feasibility of moving from one planet to another, one star system to another. A lot of people don't realize how close some of the star systems are. Of course, Alpha Centauri being the closest, and then you get out there to Sirius, Deneb, which you can see in the night sky, Arcturus a little bit further out. These are feasible to reach. Now, we talked about one of the stars being, 37 light years away, but once you get pretty close to the speed of light, you're down to about 6 months spacecraft time. That doesn't change the Earth time. So if you had a 40-year-old man leaving here and going to a star 37 light years away, by the time he got back a couple of years his time, his children would be much older than he is. So you see the quandary that traveling at very high speeds can have, changing the way one human life relates to another. When we watch this on television, like Star Trek, or we watch some of the other space movies, we don't take that in consideration. We see Captain Kirk leave and come back pretty much in the same lifetime as the people that are here on the Earth. That isn't really what would happen. As you approach faster and faster speeds, that formula, that 186,000 miles per second, that 300,000 kilometers per second, is what changes. Not the distance. It's the second that changes. It becomes asymptotic, that is to say, the curve of how fast time actually travels relative to the outside world changes ever so slowly and approaches zero. At the speed of light, the time is so slow that mass becomes infinity. If you take the equation E is equal to M times the speed of light squared, with the speed of light also being a fraction. And it becomes unthinkable for us. It's sort of like thinking about the beginning of the existence of the universe. We wrestle with it. We spend a lot of money trying to understand it. But no ending is a lot easier to understand than no beginning. It's the same thing about reaching a point of no time passing. Basically, you would be, if you shot a bullet inside your spacecraft, you would see that bullet travel at the normal speed of a bullet from the gun to the target. You would feel no difference whatsoever. But outside that craft, that bullet would take so long to get to the target compared to the outside of the craft that literally a universe would age and pass away in the time it took for that bullet to make it from one point to the other. So this is the challenge. This is the quandary, the paradox that we face. Have we ever really tested it? No, we haven't. We accelerate particles at very close to the speed of light now. And we really don't know what happens on the particle end. And we slam them into each other and we watch them come apart against a detector of one kind or another. And we're understanding a little more about the origin of the universe. But as to really, you know, what happens from the perspective of the particle, we're not really sure. On the one hand, we think, oh, a photon leaves the star Sirius, and it takes all those light years to get from Sirius to here so that I can see the star Sirius with my eye. In the meantime, it has to avoid all of these magnetic fields and other particles, and if it doesn't get annihilated along the way, then I get to behold the star Sirius at night. Well, from the photon's point of view, when that photon is actually generated at the star Sirius from whatever reaction generates it, making oxygen or nitrogen or carbon or helium, there's no pathway from the photon from that star to here, to Earth, because the photon is traveling at the speed of light. Therefore, time slows down to, you guessed it, zero, which means the entire universe is local to that photon. The photon can behold the past, the present, and the future all at once, which is a quality that we assign to God. So, as we have the capability, as you heard Stanton talk about in the final hour, of these ion drives, being able to shove ions out the back of a nozzle or out the back of a craft at the speed of light with millions of times more thrust than you're going to ever get out of a chemical rocket. A chemical rocket, you might get 6,000 feet per second out of a chemical rocket. That's about a full-on explosion of C4, about 6,000 feet per second. But fusion, you can get much, much higher velocities than that. And you don't have to accelerate once you get into space. You don't have to accelerate at 10 or 9 or 8 Gs. You only have to accelerate maybe at 1 G. Now, if you're constantly accelerating at 1 G, guess what you have? You have one gravity. So if you weigh 200 pounds here on Earth, where you are accelerating toward the center of the Earth at 32 feet per second or 21 miles an hour, you happen to be stopped by the ground, but that's what you're doing. You're accelerating toward the center of the Earth or toward the center of the crust. In space, you would be doing the same thing, increasing your speed at 21 miles an hour constantly. So, as Stan said, in about 1 year of that, you would be going 99.999% of the speed of light. But you don't have to do that. I would think it gets a little difficult to navigate, since you have to slow at 1G for a year, and anything can happen in a year. I would think that maybe you could accelerate at a G and a half for a while, and then 1G and 3/4 of a G, and whatever, you can change that around. But the point is, you don't have to go slinging around like a centrifuge, getting all sick to your stomach like a merry-go-round. You've got steady, straight-line gravity. You can pour a cup of coffee. You can grow beans. You can keep your bones strong and do weightlifting and everything that you would normally do, because everything's going to be slammed to the back of that craft at one gravity, or its weight on Earth. So I would think it becomes very practical. In fact, if you want to travel to the nearest star system, which is just barely 5 light years away, you're probably talking about a 6-month trip, maybe 4 months. Certainly it would be practical to go to Mars. Instead of taking 3 months to get to Mars, you could get to Mars in about 8 or 9 hours, accelerating at that speed. So, or 3 days. So space travel becomes much more practical. Now, people often say, well, you can't just take nuclear engines into space and launch them. I mean, that would be crazy. This is utter nonsense, people, because we have nuclear-powered submarines. We have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and boats out there that have been operating for years. Those of you that are familiar with the Russian craft, the Yamal just recently retired. after 30 years, 30 years with the same fuel supply. So it is practical. It can be done. And the amount of shielding that would be needed, yes, it would be heavy. Yes, it would be massive. But you lift it piece by piece into space and build the ships in space. Or you build the ships on the moon, where it takes 1/6 the amount of energy to lift off of the moon. And you have no atmosphere to worry about, or very little atmosphere to worry about. And guess what you have plenty of on the moon? H3. You have H3. You've got the perfect fuel right there. So the technology is at hand. The question is, do we have the will? Do we have the will to travel to the stars? Do we have the need? Yes, I believe we do. We don't understand it yet, but we do. Earth is quite a rare little jewel in the middle of space. Liquid water on the surface. We have a large variety of life with millions and millions of species. One of the most entertaining of which is man. As I heard again when I watched Contact the other night, the alien that posed as L's father said, "You are an interesting species. You're capable of such beauty and such terrible things." It is true. And although I would like to see man become less capable of all the terror that we are prone to do, I would much rather see us learn to live as one, learn to live within the bounds of the planet. We do hear arguments all the time about whether global warming is real or not. I think that planets warm and cool on their own, whether or not man's activities exacerbate that or not, it will always be a subject of debate. And we'll make the case one way, and then we'll make the case the other way here, because we want to stay open-minded. We want you to keep your wits sharp and not to prejudge anyone's ideas on the matter. Keep your intelligence about you, your open-mindedness about you. Not that I'm a big proponent of tolerance, because why would you continue to tolerate a beating when you can step away from that? But the point that I want to get across is that we must learn to live within the energy bounds of our planet. Now, you can step back and say, look, there's no harm whatsoever in pumping all this oil out of the ground, refining it, cracking it, catalytically treating it, putting it in our gas tanks, and burning it. Well, economically speaking, it's what makes the world go round. But it doesn't make any sense. It makes no sense that we have the ability to drive our cars, maybe not the big trucks, but certainly our cars, without pollution. And it seems to be the responsible thing to do. It seems to be living within the energy bounds of the planet. Electricity is much cleaner of a source of energy. Now, many of you will argue, yeah, but you burn coal and you burn natural gas to make the electricity, so where's the net gain? Well, we're moving in the right direction. We have wind energy, we have nuclear energy, and nuclear is going to graduate to fusion energy, which is a lot cleaner. You don't end up with the nuclear waste. You don't end up with the spent fuel rods. You don't have the danger of a meltdown, something that will have isotopes infesting and polluting our environment for 25,000 years. Tritium, which is the main source for these fusion reactions as you feed them to them, and deuterium, which is its lighter sister, have half-lives that are very short. I think tritium has a half-life of 12 and a half years. So even if there was an industrial accident, within 12 and a half years, you're pretty much back to background radiation. Not to mention the fact that all you really have to do is just shut the fuel supply off and the reaction stops. There's no danger of a meltdown. Now, admittedly, the particles are very small and difficult to contain, difficult to handle and pipe and magnetically compress, but it can be done. we also have a tremendous amount of hydroelectric power in our country, although there are opponents to hydroelectric power because it blocks the migration of fish up and down the stream. It also floods areas of the planet to store that much kinetic energy or that much potential energy in the height of the water, so that you can apply that energy to turbines and turn the generators and generate the electricity. The flooding of that ground is a change in the environment, and it can change the ecology of certain lifestyles that live along that way. That can be considered. Wind generation is certainly in living with the energy, the available energy on the planet. Those big fans out there, they don't slow the wind down at all. You're not changing the direction of the wind. Maybe they'll get hit by the occasional bird, but I don't think so. Those things only turn at 15 RPM. They have very slow tip speed. They're very predictable. And each one of those towers generates about 2 megawatts, which is enough to run a small town. So they make complete sense. There's another form of energy out there called tidal energy. We actually use a float, and the float goes up and down with the swells of the water. That up and down motion turns a crank or a linear accelerator of some kind and generates electricity. The ability of that to generate lots of energy has been enhanced of late because of different mechanical enhancements. Those things can be put off of islands and provide electrical power 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, totally pollution-free, without any environmental impact whatsoever, except that you're running a few lights on the island now because you're generating electricity. Also, generators can be used in rivers, not unlike the ones in the dams, except that the turbines actually are placed on the bottom of the river. So the water just flows through these giant slow-motion blades, which turns generators. We also have tidal generators in the sense that they can be used to make bridges in the high and low latitudes of the Earth, where tides are very high. As you know, the tides up in the northern climes, up in New England and up in Alaska, are much higher than the tides that are down, say, in California or Mexico, and almost no tidal activity whatsoever around the equator, because the water moves back and forth as it's pulled by the moon from one pole to the other, but in the middle it doesn't really move that much. So as those tidal flows move in and out of bays or up and down, they can be used to generate clean, renewable energy for a long, long time. And then we also have, because of that electricity that's produced, it can be used to charge up vehicles, and the battery technology is coming a long way because a lot of grant money is being fed to battery suppliers right now. I think it's a good idea, but I think there are more battery ideas out there than just lithium ion. Lithium ion is certainly a good way to store energy. It's a good way to discharge energy. It's a little unpredictable right now because, as you know, if you own or have owned an old cell phone or laptop, that the batteries can go into thermal runaway. They can actually get quite hot, and they can burst into flames. Now, that wouldn't necessarily happen with a car unless you didn't have a really good battery management system. Some battery systems, like nickel metal hydride, they're a little too heavy, a little too toxic to make, so they're not ready for prime time, although that's the battery that the Prius has been using for a long time. And then we have the nickel-zinc batteries, which are okay, but they really can't take fast recharging. And then we have cobalt batteries, which are coming along. Some of the prototypes are still small, but they're, you know, won't be too much longer, 5, maybe 10 years, we're going to have cobalt batteries, and those are going to be usable. And then, of course, we got the old standby, which is the lead acid battery, which is a very predictable 2-volt reaction. And it's easy to use, easy to recharge, not toxic, and they can be easily recycled. One of my listeners writes in and says, the reason I'm interested in electric cars is electricity doesn't require a degree in chemical engineering to generate it yourself. And if you generate it yourself, the energy is virtually free, except for the cost of the equipment. This is true. If you live in the desert, wind generator is a wonderful idea because there's not much to stop the wind, or in the high mountains, and the wind is pretty plentiful. Now, some of the car companies out there, I know Vision Motor Cars is putting solar cells on their vehicles. A little bit more about that later. But solar technology is definitely clean and renewable. The problem is that most of the cells that are out there are not very high density, and they're rather expensive. The process alone is pretty expensive. For instance, one square meter, just about 40 inches by 40 inches, that'll put out about 140 watts in bright sunlight, which isn't a whole lot of electricity. It can run, four or five small fluorescent light bulbs, one panel. But you'd have to store that energy during the day so that you can use the energy at night when you need the light. The fact that the sun will continue to put out energy, we hope, and the solar cells really don't diminish, or the solar panels don't diminish in output for years and years and years, maybe 10 or 15 years, if that. The glass ones are subject to etching, so I would avoid those. And there are polymer-coated ones that do quite well, don't yellow in the sunlight. And they're lightweight. But we're still talking about $400 for a square meter. And that's just not feasible for most people. For most people, if they want to cover the roof of their house with a durable solar panel, they're probably talking $20,000 to $25,000. Now, the cost of electricity for the average size home is going to be between, what, $100 and $250 a month. Well, even at $250 a month, do the math, people. You're talking $3,000 a year, and $3,000 a year divided into 25 grand is a little over 8 years. 8 years to pay it back. I'm sorry, most people don't own their homes for 8 years. So they're not going to invest 25 grand in putting solar panels on a home unless somebody's going to help them foot the bill. Right now, you guys are doing it through your taxes. You're footing the bill so that people of means can afford to spend 25 grand covering their house roof with solar cells, can add solar cells to their house. Now, keep in mind, that house is already connected to the grid. That house already runs on AC. All the lights in it, all the air conditioning, all the stove and the refrigerator, everything runs on AC. If you really want to be forward thinking about this, and you're thinking about building a house in the next 2 or 3 years, why don't you think about a DC house, one that doesn't have any AC in it? I can tell you right now, 24-volt systems are pretty standard in industry. You can buy almost any kind of equipment to run on 24 volts. There are all kind of motors that run on 24 volts, lights that run on 24 volts, LEDs that run on 24 volts. And you could convert your house to a combination of wind and solar, and you could have all the lights that you need. Now, if you insist on having air conditioning where you can keep your house 65 degrees while it's 110 degrees outside, think about a few options. Many of my friends who live in Arizona don't use heat pumps or Freon-based air conditioning. They use swamp coolers, ordinary swamp coolers. This is a filtered system that you simply trickle water over the filter and use a fan to pull the air into the house and out through the windows in the evening or when you come home from work, and it rehumidifies the house and can cool the house down to a very comfortable 65 degrees. And these are areas that have very low humidity. In the summertime, 5 or 10% humidity. So the water evaporates very quickly, gets nice and cold, rehumidifies the house, making it much more comfortable to live in, and uses a fraction of the energy that a standard air conditioner or a heat pump would use, because there's no compressor to turn. And the motor that runs that fan can definitely run on 24 volts. So there you have it. You've got a solution. Now, in the areas where you have high humidity, like in Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia, North Carolina, Kentucky, Tennessee, Ohio, those places that have very high humidity, you're going to have to look for a different solution if you want to get your temperatures down to those areas. I will tell you what they do in foreign countries. You're not going to like it, but this is what they do. It's called air conditioning, but it's not central heat and air. All they do is they cool or heat the room that they're in. Even the very expensive houses have area coolers and area heaters that go in that house. Why? Because the cost of energy in those countries is already prohibitively high. And when it's high like that, they had to come up with solutions so that they could afford to heat and cool their homes. The United States isn't that way. We will put a 5-ton or a split system with a 3-ton and a 2-ton in an ordinary house. And we don't mind spending $200 or $300 a month to cool that house in the summertime or heat that house in the wintertime using that heat pump or using natural gas and an air conditioner. But that's an awful waste of energy. An awful waste of energy. So there are solutions that do work. There are ways of insulating homes where they don't have such a heat load on them, so that you can have a smaller air conditioner that uses way less energy and gets that house down to a cool temperature without so much of the sun load upon it. And I would start thinking about those kinds of things. Why? Because it makes sense. Because there is not an unlimited amount of fossil fuels on the earth. And even if there was, it makes no sense whatsoever to dig the planet up and shovel it in a tank and burn it. Burning fossil fuels is dumb. And if there are aliens visiting this world, they got to be looking at us saying, boy, are those guys dumb. You go to Europe and you go to Asia and you look around, what you don't see are trees. The reason you don't see the trees is because in centuries past, burning wood was the only way to get heat. That's right. And so they literally cut down their forests and burned them all. And now they have no forests left. We will end up doing the same thing to our country. We harvest trees just like we harvest corn. But we change the ecology, we change the way life lives on this planet when we do that. So all I'm saying is that there are ways to use and generate electricity that are clean. I was reading a blog today as I was preparing a plan, and I noticed that 76% of likely car buyers in the United States would consider buying an electric vehicle in the next 5 years. Rasmussen ran a poll that said 17% of likely car buyers would buy an electric vehicle this year. So the mindset is beginning to change, and the ability to move away from a carbon burning society to one that lives within the energy bounds of the planet is coming along. I'm proud to say it's coming along. And maybe programs like X Squared Radio, programs like other talk radio programs and some of the Discovery Channel, History Channel, Nat Geo, all those channels are having their effect. And maybe it's the fact that that the companies are having to boost the price of their stock by saying, we're green, we're heading that way, stick with us, don't give up on us yet. We're making buggy whips now, but I promise we're going to come up with something more efficient here in the future. And people are trying to stick with it. Maybe that's having its effect too. And maybe when the market, the buyer, you, the consumer, gets to the point where you're ready to spend your money on such a thing, it will become a reality. We have about 20 minutes left in the program. Phone number, if you want to call in, is 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. Tonight we had Kathleen Marden and we had Stanton Friedman. Stanton Friedman is a household name when it comes to UFOs. He's been lecturing a long, long time on the subject. We really appreciate the work that he's done, that he does. He's a fine, fine man, fine lecturer, great intellect. It's fun to sit down and talk with him. If you want to do so, if you want to sit down with the likes of Stanton Friedman, he's been on Larry King Live many, many times. As I said, a household name in the idea of UFOs. You should go to one of the conferences where he's going to speak. If you want to find out where he's going to be speaking, go to stantonfriedman.com, stantonfriedman.com, all one word, and just look up the conferences where he's going to be lecturing. Kathleen Marden is Kathleen with a K, dash, Marden, M-A-R-D-E-N.com. And they're speaking at a lot of the same conventions in the next year because they co-authored this book, which is called Science Was Wrong. Like, that's a big shock to everyone. When I tell people I'm a scientist, they kind of look sideways at me like, gee, what does that really mean? You do science for a living? Can that really be done? Yes, it can. And, you know, if you learn enough in science, sooner or later you're going to become unemployable. You'll have to work for yourself or write books or lecture or teach school. You can know too much to be useful to employers. 415-762-1161. In our first hour, I did talk a lot about the economics of what's happening, what's going on the planet, and I kind of rushed through it. I want to brush back over just a little bit because it really had a powerful effect on putting the program together. You got to realize that the analysts out there are trying to figure out what's going on, what kind of prediction, what kind of effect, what kind of strategy can they take to get this economy to come back. You know, the bleak conclusion of analysts on Friday was that unemployment will remain in the double digits for the foreseeable future after the government said economic growth crawled at a 2.4% pace in the spring of this year. 2.4%, people, is less than the cost of living, okay? That means the economy is not moving. It's not quite as bad as a depression, but it is certainly a recession where we have, for all intents and purposes, negative growth. It was the economy's weakest showing in nearly a year, and many economists think growth is even slower now, because now we're in the summer. Remember, these are spring numbers. We're not supposed to have slow growth in the summer. We're supposed to be ordering things. We're supposed to be building things. We're supposed to be hiring people in the summertime. I can tell you that the reason they think the economy is slowing is because you have lost confidence in the economy. You're not going out to the store and spending your money at Walmart. You're not buying new cars. The only reason the economy moved at all is because the government juiced it by giving home buying tax credits. These reports of growth are to make you feel better about the economy so that you will mysteriously go out and start spending money again. But what they haven't figured out is that you don't have any money to spend. You are already underemployed. You are already making as much money as you can possibly make. And you're not going to lose the job that you have, even though you know you're underemployed. Even though you know that your employer is not paying you what you're worth, you're not going to quit. And that means that between buying gasoline and paying the high cost of credit card debt, if you haven't already filed bankruptcy, and if you have filed bankruptcy, then you can't buy anything anyway, because nobody's going to extend credit to you to go buy, at least not for 7 years. So you're not able to go to the store and stimulate the economy. Why? Because you're not working at a job that gives you enough money to be able to do that. Now, one could argue, well, that's because you overspent in the past, and that's why you can't make your bills and blah, blah, blah. Maybe so. But if you really wanted to help the economy, the thing to do would be to generate more jobs. Gee, sounds like we've been hearing that from the White House for a couple of years. Well, what's the problem? The government is spending billions and billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, in grants and loans and loan guarantees. Why haven't the jobs come along? The reason they haven't come along is because all of that money is being spent with the status quo. It's not being spent with small business. And frankly, I resent the name of small business being used in vain by the politicians, throwing it about as if they were saying they were good Christians, throwing it about to let the public know that somewhere, some small business somewhere is getting a hand up so that they can help us create jobs. Nonsense. It isn't happening. It is not happening. In fact, I have it on very good authority that there is a policy that small business is not going to be given money to create jobs. And that somewhere in the halls of Congress, the mantra is floating around on an hourly basis. There's a reason why those guys are still in their garage. I've heard those very same words myself from Congress to my own ears and not over the air, face to face. What that tells me is that all that money, billions and billions of dollars, is going to large corporations that aren't creating any jobs. They're giving the grant money away. It's being allocated. It's going out there. But it isn't going to small business. Small business is what it is because they're starting out. It doesn't stay small forever. But if you constantly give small business the money it needs to take its ideas to market, you are constantly competitive. You're constantly growing. As we spoke tonight in the first hour about Orville and Wilbur Wright trying to get investors and grant money and loans from the government so that they could build their airplane. Well, two things were against them. One, science had an idea, a pretty firm idea, that heavier than air flight was just not possible. And second, they were a small business. Well, if government would just take a different attitude and say, you know, anything is possible, so let's listen to every reasonable proposal. And the second is, let's give the money to small business, especially guys that are in their garage, so that we can get these great ideas to come forth. We can get these ideas, if not to market, then maybe to the businesses who have the ability to bring it to market. In any case, it would be like investing in education in a community. You know, I remember when Ronald Reagan was governor of California. In those days, tuition was very, very high. California had 11 state universities. Ronald Reagan did something that was very bold, and it put the state in a lot of financial trouble for a while. He made all 11 state campuses free tuition to in-state students. That's right. All the money was put in place so that in-state students, if they went to a state university, either tuition was very low or non-existent. Only the private universities, like Berkeley and all those, only the private universities would not qualify for that. Now, it was an investment. And what happened is within 20 years of that policy, California had the highest educated populace in the world. And boy, did they start driving things. A little area, a little sleepy area called Silicon Valley popped up. And the rest is history. And for a long, long time, California was by itself in the top dozen economies in the world. Just the state of economy. Just the state of California. Just the state of California was competing with nations because they had that much ability to earn income based on their intellect. When I see communities that will not invest in a school, I see a community that is going to die. When I see a bank that will not loan money for the needs of their community, I see a bank that's going to be bought out by another bank in the near future. When I see a government who will not invest its money in the small business of its country, I see a government that is going to fail. Will the country fail? Probably not. Because what's driving those entrepreneurs is a fire in the belly to see that idea come to fruition. And I think as long as that national fire exists, there is hope for the people. I did say that the government would go out of business because the people will lose their faith in it. And when the people lose their faith in their government, it must change. Does that mean that we're going to move away from the Constitution as a form of government? I think we did that a long time ago. And if you have any ideas to the contrary, I would like to hear them. 415-762-1161. I think we moved away from the constitutional ideals a long time ago. When the 16th Amendment was passed, when the 22nd Amendment was passed, those of you that aren't familiar with those, the 16th Amendment was the income tax, and the 22nd Amendment allowed senators to run for election. Remember, they used to be appointed by state legislators, which made them a lot more answerable to we, the people. Herodotus was right when he said the death of any nation is when the general populace can vote for themselves a piece of the coffer. We have a huge population of professional voters in this country. What do I mean by professional voters? I mean voters who are paid to vote. That's right. Voters that receive a regular check, either yearly or monthly, and they are paid to vote. And if they stop voting a certain way, they stop getting that check. Well, that has become the bane of freedom in our country. We have so many special interest groups that are voting for themselves a piece of the coffer. And before you think you're not a special interest group, listen up, AARP. Listen up, people that are on welfare. Listen up, people that get food stamps. You feel as though if you don't vote a certain way, you're going to lose those benefits. I want to alleviate that fear from you once and for all, because it doesn't matter how you vote. Those resources will always be there. What we have to change, and if we don't change, we're going to go away. Society, the nation, the people, the states, the world is going to do something else. I don't want to talk about what that is, but it's going to do something else. We have got to begin moving our money away from these black projects, away from war, away from the major corporations. We've got to start feeding the money to small businesses. Those are the groups that are going to form the jobs. And they're going to form the jobs in the most important places that we need them. In our towns, in our counties, in our small cities. That's where they're going to form the jobs. Some of them will only hire 10 people. Some will hire 100. Some might be extra successful and hire 500. But they will all be real jobs. They will all receive paychecks, and those paychecks will pay payroll taxes, and that money will be local, right in the communities. Even if a small business goes broke because their idea for one reason or another didn't make it, either because they couldn't manage it, or they couldn't build it, or a better idea came along and they couldn't compete against it, but that's the American way. When we funnel billions of dollars to giant global conglomerates like General Motors, or we funnel money to oil companies, or we funnel money to companies that are already multinational billion-dollar corporations, we hurt the public good. We must help the public good with our money. And that's what we have to concentrate on. So as November comes along, maybe we'll talk about it a little more. We'll bring it a little closer to home. You're with me here at X Squared Radio, and I appreciate so much you being here. If your archive subscription is about to run out at BBS Radio or X Squared Radio, please re-sign up. And when you do, tell a friend about us, because those subscriptions are what help keep the lights on right here. We make no money off this effort. We do it because we love it. If you don't believe me, call up Don and ask him. Call me up and ask me. I will tell you directly. This isn't a career. It's a hobby. It's a passion. We do it for you so that you will have free press, so that you will have the truth unabashed, unedited, pure, right from the heart. And we do it right here on X Squared Radio every week, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.